Chapter 4. Brother Anselm and the Optimist. Section 1. He came striding across the grass, and a flower bed, to where they were sitting in the shade. Brother Anselm knew him, the younger of the three who had carried the cripple down to the monastery on that tragic night. The Optimist was the cripple's name for him. "How are we? How are we?" this person exuberated in vibrant tones. "What air! What—" "It's all right," said the cripple to Brother Anselm. "He's pumping up. It's a habit." The Optimist was taking in deep breaths, signifying the same with alternate undulations of the chest and abdominal regions. "Do stop those pneumatics. We're discussing big things. You'd better join in." This from the cripple again. The exuberant one, having attained the right air pressure, spread himself on the grass and surveyed the other two with an all-embracing smile. He was the embodiment of life and vigor, of physical energy, bristled with it from head to foot. Brother Anselm had already found him an interesting person, with very strong views on life, very pugnacious over them, and very anxious to air them. There had been one or two friendly scraps between them before now. Untrammeled by what he called the outworn dogmas of religion, his intellectual activities found play in such pastimes as Christian Science. The doctrines of Nietzsche shared his attentions. Also, H.G. Wells. And he couvaed daily, at cockcrow, morn, and eventide. Snippets and tags culled from his hero's somewhat divergent philosophies of life and repeated at intervals supplied fuel for the fervid aspirations of his soul. What he aspired to, Brother Anselm could not quite make out. He called it the realization of the divinity within, but became vague when asked to explain. As a reward for Nietzschean proclivities, the cripple had labeled him the magnificent blonde beast, and he rather looked it sprawling there on the grass. "You were talking. What's the argument?" he beamed at them. "Put that last question again," said Brother Anselm to the cripple. "Why is there pain and suffering in the world? That's what I was asking," he replied. The Optimist sprang like a terrier on a rat. "Suffering? Pain? No such things. Inventions. Illusions." "Don't bark," said the cripple. "I knew you'd say that. Is this trouble of mine an illusion?" "Ah, that's because you don't understand. If you understood the divine metaphysics of Christian Science, you would realize there is no such thing as matter. There is only mind. Excuse me interrupting," said Brother Anselm, "but instead of Mrs. Eddy's generalizations, wouldn't it be better to answer the question? Is his accident and all the pain of it merely an illusion? There is no pain in truth and no truth in pain." Mrs. Eddy's dictum came out pat. "As long as you think wrongly, you will think as you do about it. It's a matter of right thinking." "I should have thought it was a matter of fact," answered the monk. "Suffering and pain are self-evident facts, unless we are all lunatics. Is it right thinking to sweep aside the age-long experience of mankind, to deny what is confirmed by universal consent? If Christian Science is true, then the human race is a race of imbeciles. Right thinking? If Christian Science were right, human reason could never be trusted again. Who is Mrs. Eddy to turn up in the 19th century AD with no credentials beyond a presumptuous claim to a special revelation and a marked ability for writing jargon? Who is she to pit herself against the common sense of humanity?" The onslaught was unexpected. The Optimist steadied himself with more pneumatics, seeking for a suitable tag. "Pop guns out of action. Get your heavies on him," encouraged the cripple. The tag would not come. The textbooks did not provide for this. Finally, he tried to maneuver the corner with, "Don't forget there are thousands of Christian Scientists." "Yes," said Brother Anselm. "And why?" "Because there are thousands for whom Christian Science provides a nice, easy platform for sliding off from Christianity into paganism, and because there are thousands who won't have pain and suffering." The Optimist saw an opening. "And you insist on pain and suffering, you Catholics, and in doing so, you land yourselves in a very nice dilemma. If there are these physical evils, then there are defects in the world. I'd very much like to know how the infinitely perfect God you claim could create a world with defects in it." "That's a heavy," muttered the cripple. He was all ears now. This was his own question, in another form. "God could create any world he chose," the monk smiled back, "with or without defects. If he couldn't, he wouldn't be God. God can do anything he chooses. You can't limit the creator to a particular creation. God is infinite, unlimited. Actually, he has created a world with defects in it, but these defects do not argue against his infinite perfection. What? A God of goodness in a world of pain? Certainly, there is no contradiction. Pain and suffering are defects, permitted by God, yes, but defects in a relative sense only. I mean relative to physical well-being. They are not strictly evils, but the natural accompaniment of sentient life. Why shouldn't God create beings liable to pain and suffering, provided, of course, that his eternal purposes are served by doing so? Oh, I don't know anything about his eternal purposes, the optimist sounded impatient. Exactly, and therefore you are scarcely in a position to judge. If the end of man's creation were merely material comfort and prosperity, then I admit it would be extremely difficult to reconcile pain with perfect goodness. The humanitarian world of today places its chief good in material well-being and is up against God because pain and suffering are in its way. The folly of the thwarted child that sulks. But supposing pain and suffering minister to man's great end, supposing by their very means that end is most perfectly realized, supposing that to be so, then the goodness of God is not in question. The great end, exclaimed the optimist, ignoring Brother Anselm. He stood up and walked about. His eyes were shining. The great end. Yes, to attain it, pain and suffering must be despised, laughed at, denied. The very notion of them is fatal to man's end. Real or unreal, I would shout from the housetops, down with pain, down with disease, trample them under, cast them out, barnacles on the bark of humanity. How can they minister to the great end of man? The end? Man's end is Superman. Keep off the flower bed, from the cripple. Efficiency, the will to power, defiance, those are the ministers to man's end. Disease, weakness, pain, these things, I mean, these illusions, hang round man's neck like a curse. The unfit, I mean, those who think they are, must sacrifice themselves to the earth that one day it may bring forth supermen. Damaged goods are an encumbrance to humanity. I've no use for Christianity and its sympathy with these horrors. Imaginary horrors. It counteracts the law of natural selection, the survival of the fittest. It preserves instead of weeding out. It hinders, shackles man's whole being, as men will come to see. Man will march on over the strewn wreckage of dogmas and creeds to the grandeur of his godhood, to the realization of the divinity within, to the perfect expression of eternal consciousness, to the perfection of himself, which is God. Yes, to his godhood, the earth for the gods that shall be. The outburst was dramatic, but apparently sincere. High velocity, from the ambulance. Brother Anselm turned to the cripple. Were you with the gunners in the war?
I was, yes.
The monk picked a blade of grass and began to suck it. Section 2. A sense of annoyance pervaded the optimist, marring the triumph of the moment. Brother Anselm seemed unaffected by the peroration, not even impressed. He suddenly felt young. There was an embarrassing weight. The monk went on sucking the blade of grass.
Well? From the optimist, distinctly picked.
Well, what? From Brother Anselm.
What?
Yes, what?
The monk laughed, but quite good-naturedly. I'm trying a delay fuse, he said. I want you to calm down and listen. May I first remark that the last part of your utterance means nothing to me, and it means nothing to you, the godhood and divinity part. These flamboyant expressions mean nothing even to the humanitarians who coin them. They mean no more than the goodness, beauty, and truth of the modernists. It is all so much verbiage, camouflaging the denial of a personal god and blinding men to their final end.
You're evading me, interrupted the other.
I am not. I'm doing a preliminary canter to clear the ground. Do let's understand what we're talking about. When I speak of man's end, I mean his final end in God, his creator, in heaven. Not an imaginary end in himself here on earth, as pictured by you. That in a moment, though. May I make another remark on what you said?
By all means, coldly polite.
Very well. In your gods and supermen, I seem to recognize snatches of Nietzsche and H.G. Wells. I fancy your dislike of Christianity is borrowed, too. I'm going to be appallingly rude, but have you ever thought out what you have just said? No, you have not. There is no thought behind it.
It is quite easy, as many prove today, to rattle off the crude notions of impertinent critics who imagine they can run this world very much better than its creator.
Do you mind sitting down?
Thank you. The humanitarian scheme sounds magnificent on paper, or in the air. In real life, this weeding out of the unfit would mean a ceaseless campaign of murder, in Wellesian language, a certain deliberate elimination, until a few magnificent monsters were left, devils of selfishness, ruthless, unpitying beasts. And they, in their time, might well turn and rend each other, cursing their impotence to find immunity from disease. No. On humanity's brow is written large, disease, and suffering, and pain. Shall man delete that writing? The optimist was experiencing a sense of deflation. He ejected, but, and stuck.
Forgive me if I've been too straight, said Brother Anselm. Now, here's my real contribution. Granted, man's final end as intended by God, that means seeing and possessing God in heaven and, in consequence, enjoying eternal happiness, happiness beyond all human imagination. Granting that, then a very different light is thrown on pain and suffering. We then see them as constant reminders that man's final aim and happiness lie beyond this world, that he must suffer and endure, that he may not snatch the victory unearned. We see them as rungs in the ladder of life, for the scaling of heroic heights. We see this world as a vast crucible into which men are plunged for their testing, for eternal life. For those who shirk the test, the world becomes a cauldron. For those who face it, a crucible of love. Brother Anselm leant over the cripple. Do you understand? The pale face lit. Yes, the crucible. I like that. Now, said Brother Anselm to the optimist, I want 2 minutes private conversation, strictly private, with this perambulator. I've got something to tell him. Do you think you could sort of run about the garden? The optimist said most certainly he would take exercise, and walked off, head in the air. Really, this monk was insufferable. Was he a schoolboy? Damn the flowerbed. He must collect his thoughts. All that religious stuff, a fool could answer it. 2 minutes private conversation. Bah! 2 minutes to put him off. He paced up and down at a distance. Yes, infernally rude of the monk, jabbering away there as if he didn't exist. That chap Ing was right. A Roman priest could never be a gentleman. More pacing. 2 minutes. 20 more like. Still more pacing. Suddenly there was a crash, and the next moment he was hopping about on one leg. He had failed to notice a garden barrow left on the path. His expletives were interrupted by a shout from the cripple. Don't worry, old man, don't worry. It's only an illusion. The optimist looked daggers, and then burst out laughing. His ill humor had gone. Come here, called the cripple. I want to say something to you. The optimist limped back, somewhat puzzled. First, said the cripple, put your hand there. He did so, wondering what this was about. Brother Anselm has just been telling me. Telling you what? It was you who climbed down and got me up. That night on the mountains.
The optimist colored like a boy.
And you never told me, said the cripple.
The other stuttered something about it being the sort of thing any fellow would do.
Not everybody, said Brother Anselm. Yes, I found out all about it. You let yourself down into that crevasse, and you knew that you might never get back, even by yourself, let alone with the weight of his body. You knew that well enough, and yet you did it. And you only got him back after a struggle. That must have been a long hell of torture.
Put it there again, said the cripple. The optimist did so.
You're a brick. You're... That's all right.
The cripple stammered and became hopelessly mixed, and the optimist more embarrassed.
I shouldn't be here if you hadn't done it.
Damned glad I did it, then. The optimist was getting redder still. Brother Anselm relieved matters by leading him away. He looked him in the eyes.
I want to thank you myself for giving me a very dear person to look after.
The optimist could only blurt out, It's awfully decent of you to be so generous. Sorry I was so beastly rude just now about your religion.
And I'm sorry if I was hard on you. But it wasn't really you I was being hard on. It was those lies, those devil's lies that fool men off the track. I was hard on them because of my respect for you. Because I don't want to see a man, like the man you are, being gulled.
Look here, you two, interjected the cripple. I've got a question to ask. Sit down, Magnificence, and answer this.
Magnificence obeyed.
May I annoy you?
Rather, replied the optimist.
Then tell me, if you really believe, as you said, that the unfit must go, why, in the name of heaven, did you save me?
You must have known something even then, when you looked down, when you saw my body on that ledge. You must have known that, even if you got me up alive, you would only be salving a bit of wreckage. If you really believe all you said just now, you ought to have left me there, damaged goods, an encumbrance to humanity. You did not leave me there.
Why?
There was no answer. Brother Anselm looked at the optimist. The optimist looked at the grass. A bird hopped up, put its head on one side, and hopped off. Brother Anselm looked at the cripple. The cripple looked at Brother Anselm. Then they both looked at the optimist, licking his lips. A clock in the monastery tower wheezed, struck, and saved the situation. The optimist murmured something about getting back to the hotel. Brother Anselm stood up. But, the cripple began. No, don't. The monk stopped him. The optimist looked gratefully at Brother Anselm. 5 minutes later, he was swinging his way across the fields.
Good sort, that monk, he muttered. If ever I meet that chap Ing,